This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is for Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenso, case 39. Jingwing's Buddha Dharma at the New Year, the main case. Master Jingwing was asked by a student, is there Buddha Dharma at the beginning of the New Year? And Jingwing said, yes. The student said, what is the Buddha Dharma at the beginning of the New Year? And Jingwing said, the beginning of the year is auspicious. The myriad things are all new. And the student said, thank you for your answer, teacher. Jingwing said, today I lost virtue. Later, another student asked Zen Master Fori, is there Buddha Dharma at the beginning of the new year? And Fori said, no. The student said, every year is a good year. Every day is a good day. How is it not in the new year? Fori said, when old man Zhang drinks wine, old man Li gets drunk. The student said, old, old, big, big, a dragon head, a snake tail. Fori said, today I lost virtue. The commentary. Since both students ask, is there Buddha Dharma at the beginning of the new year, why does Jingwing say yes and Fori say no? If you go to words and phrases to see into this, you'll never understand. If, however, you're free of mind and objects, and have attained liberation, you certainly have a life apart from yes and no. Tell me, what is a life apart from yes and no? Before the new year, the cold moon illuminates the endless mountain. After the new year, the sweet fragrance of apple blossoms fills the valley. On New Year's Day itself, there is no before or after, just the vast and boundless sky, free of every hindrance. It is here that both masters answer. If I'd been there when the monastic said, thank you for your answer, I would have struck him with my stick and said, now I have gained virtue. When the other student said, dragon head, snake tail, I would have driven them out with a shout and said, now I have gained virtue. The poem. One raises it up, the other pushes it down. In their loss of virtue, both are completely free. So, during this past week, when I knew that I would be coming back, I started to write this talk about the new year, given that this is a new year. And so maybe I'll talk a little bit more about death and dying next week, having just been with my mother in her dying. You know, in the poem, she was a potter, and so in the poem I invoked the image of a vase on a shelf falling and breaking, shattered. And you may not have noticed, but when I came up to offer incense and I took out a small container of powdered incense, a special incense, I dropped it, and all the incense fell out. And I heard her laughing. Shattered, collapse, eh? I may be deceased, but I'm still your mother. So watch it. So the new year is a way of marking time. Days, months, years. It's something we create. And so the question really, as Buddhist practitioners, is how do we use it? Do we use that well? Does it help us? Do we put it in the service of our liberation, or does it confine us in some way? When my mother passed away on Thursday morning, and on Wednesday, the hospice nurse came to check on her, and we were talking to him afterwards, and she was at this point not visibly conscious, and we were just asking for his, you know, sense of where she was at, and he said, you know, in hospice, he said, we measure people's dying process in weeks to months, days to weeks, hours to days, minutes to hours. And he said his sense was that she was in minutes to hours. And I thought it was such an interesting way of looking at the passage of that period of time at the end of our life, as though things are, you know, shortening or collapsing or condensing, when really it's the same as at every other moment. It's this. It's now. And it was also interesting to me that in the days leading up to her death and while she was still conscious, that almost every time I or my siblings would go in to see her, the first thing she would do is she would look over at the clock, or she would ask, what time is it? What day is it? And I was just found that very curious. Like, what was that for her? You know, that importance of time, of knowing what time it was at that time in her life. She also said at one point when she looked at the clock and she said, what day is it? And it was Sunday. And she said, Sunday? She said, what are you doing here? You have to give a sermon. I said, no, Ma, it's all taken care of. And she said, no, you should go. You should go. You have to go give a sermon. There's a very famous sutra in the canon where the Buddha talks about the messengers. And the story is that a man has died, and he's meeting Yama, who's the Lord of Death, the Lord of the Death Realm. And this man is brought before Yama, and the attendants who are bringing him forward are basically saying, this guy didn't live very well, Yama. And he said he was unfriendly, he was divisive, he was not virtuous, he didn't honor his elders and his family, so mete out his suitable punishment. And then Yama goes through this very interesting questioning process. And he says, didn't you notice the first messenger that I sent to you? And the man says, no, I didn't. And he says, don't you remember seeing among the many human beings you encountered in the world, a man or a woman who was 80 or 90 years old, who was decayed and bent like the framework of a roof, who was going about supported on a stick and shivering, ill with broken teeth and gray hair? And the man says, yes, I saw such a person. And Yama says, well, being an intelligent, mature person, didn't it occur to you that you have not yet freed yourself from this state, not yet freed yourself from the fear of being such a person? And the man said, no, I did not. He said, I could not do it owing to my own negligence. And Yama said, well, owing to your negligence, you acted in such a manner, ignoring that messenger. And all of the negative actions that you did in your life were not done by your mother or your father, your brothers or sisters, by your friends or colleagues. They were only done by you. And he says, therefore, you must experience the consequences of those actions. You must bear the burden of your own karma. And then he goes on to ask about the next messenger, was somebody who was very sick, and asking the same series of questions. Did you see and receive this messenger's message? And the man says, no, I did not. And then, did you see the messenger of death? Did you ever encounter someone who had died? And the man said, yes. And he says, well, didn't it occur to you that you too are subject to death? And didn't that motivate you to live your life more virtuously, more wakefully, and begin to take responsibility for your life in a different way? And the man says, no, I was negligent. And Yama basically says, well, there's nothing I can do about that. We each are the owners of our own karma. And I think that's such an important teaching, you know, that in every person that we see, in a sense, we're taught to see as a Buddha, not only somebody who possesses self-nature, Buddha nature, regardless of how they're acting, but also someone who, because of how they appear to us and because of how they're acting, are giving us a message. They're teaching us something. And that if we're negligent and don't actually see it and reflect back on that, how am I living my life? Do I see in this aged person, in this person who is sick, in this person who is dying or has died, do I see my own life? And if not, Yama is saying we're being negligent, we're not understanding. And so even the Lord of Death is a Dharma teacher. Waste nothing. And so being at the beginning of the year is a time where we do such reflection. That's how we can use this time well. And the Buddha realized that in our expressed desires, in our intentions, in our vows, we're bringing forth one of the greatest powers we have, spiritual power. But a spiritual power because of the non-duality of all things that reaches into every part of our life. And then the question becomes, are we using that well? Are we using the desires that arise within us well? And do we know how to discern how to use the different desires that arise within us? Are we bringing forth desires that would be very well put to use? And are we doing that? This is a very important part of being awake, of living and practicing a path of awakening. At the same time that we know that past, present, and future is a construction of the mind, it's an idea. Past is not anything anyone can go to. It's not anything anyone can touch. The future is not anything anyone has ever gone to. The present is not something that we can touch. It's an idea. And so then why do teachers in monasteries and sanghas gather to celebrate, to usher in, to reflect upon the new year? To be a benefit, to study, to examine, to be free within past, present, and future. Is there Buddha Dharma at the beginning of the new year? And Xingqing says, yes. The beginning of the year is auspicious. The myriad things are all new. It's auspicious. It's the new year is a sign of great significance. It's like the beginning of a day. You know, it's one of the reasons that we begin the day early. Before the sun. I'm convinced that we help the sun to rise. So you better get up before the sun. And that in that very, very important moments where the key is very powerful, in the air, in the light, in the darkness, that we begin. And we begin awake. There's a reason why we start within meditation, within zazen. That we are awake to how we begin this day. And that begins before we find ourselves on the cushion, the moment we come into waking consciousness. The beginning of this day is auspicious. The myriad things are all new. We shouldn't miss it. Every moment, every day, every hour has never arrived before. It will never return. We can never go back and retrieve it. And so the question continues to be, how will we use it? How are we using it? And at the same time, we know that it isn't something that exists unto itself. And yet within what we call a moment or an hour or a day, because of karmic streams, because of the conditions of this very moment, there is experience, a sight, a sound, a taste, a thought, an awareness, an awakening, that comes and goes. But the karmic mind, our karmic mind, our historical mind, our past-looking mind, our forward-looking mind, creates burdens within us, anxieties, concerns, feelings of hopelessness, despair, which creates a kind of veil over things. My mother had a very thin, beautiful shawl, I guess, very, very thin though, kind of like gossamer, that she wanted to be buried in or cremated in. But before, while she was in the last days of her life, she wanted it on her. So we had to keep putting it on her. She said, "Where is it? Where is it?" She wanted to be draped in this. And when the mortuary came to take her away, my sister and I bundled her up in this. She was also a clown, and she had a character, Pickwick, what she called the character. And she told my younger sister that she wanted to be cremated in her clown costume. And Allison said, "Mom, I'm just not going to do that." But we did lay it on her and ask that she be cremated, that it be cremated along with her. But there's a veil that covers our mind that is not so beautiful, not so easily removed. And that's why we practice. I mean, Zazen is what shows us what is already present. And that's really important to understand, that whatever we experience, the highs and lows, the demons and the saints, are already present. Right? Nothing is appearing for the first time. We're just seeing it for the first time. It's all mind. It's all mind. But unless we see it, if we don't see it, we can't examine it. If we can't examine it, we can't practice it. If we can't practice it, we can't let it go and be free of it. And so these patterns that are deeply set patterns, right, that can be so binding, are what we're trying to see through and release ourselves from. That's the veil. At the same time that in a certain sense we're establishing other patterns, but patterns in wakefulness, not automatic, sort of robotic patterns of practice, but patterns, things that we return to consciously over and over again, like Zazen, like liturgy, like invocation, like the precepts, like Sangha, and establish those patterns as refuges, as places to come to life. A few days before my mom passed, she was still sort of in a liminal state where she was moving in and out of consciousness. And she was not eating or drinking and hadn't taken anything for some days. So she was very weak and was really pulling in, really pulling in. And but she heard my brother-in-law come in, and he and my sister have two huge Newfoundlands dogs. Gorgeous, gorgeous, like mountains of animal, these dogs. And my mother heard him, and she goes, Arlo's his name. And she said, "Arlo, come here." And she was just like calling out from this very, you know, sort of inward state. And so Arlo comes over and is almost towering over her. She reached out, was petting him. He's got this gorgeous fur. And then he went away. And then she was starting to do something with her hands. And my brother, he was very, very beautifully responsive. He knew exactly what she wanted at different moments. He picked up a piece of Play-Doh and just put it in her hands. And she just immediately, because she'd been potting for 40 years, 50 years, probably 60 years, actually. And she immediately, her eyes were closed, and she just started working it, working it, working it. And she made a dog. And then she laid it, first she laid it on her throat. And then she laid it on her hand, on her face. And she said, "Take me away." A couple days later, when she was not conscious at all, she did something similar where she just did something with her hands. And my brother again put a piece of Play-Doh in her hand. And just watching her, I mean, her physically, she was moments really away from death. But her hands were still a potter's hands. And she took it, and immediately she knew she tore it in half. Wasn't the right size. And she just started working it. And all of this is from this very, very deep place. And I thought, you know, that's her training. Right? That even in those moments before death, her training is so deep inside of her that it's like that's what she goes to. That's her refuge. This is our training. That in a moment just like that, or in all of the moments leading up to it, that's our refuge. Right? That's what we can turn to. And when it's that deep inside of us, right, it can come in moments that aren't deliberate, aren't intentional, aren't a result of a thought or even an intention. Tibetan master Longchenpa said, "The pure reality body, luminous and clear, is the Buddha nature of all things. Yet due to our delusion and clinging, we wander in the cycle of existence, in the wilderness of karma and defilement. We stray in weariness." I think that's so powerful. We stray within our weariness. We wander within our weariness. Today, may we bring our exhausted minds to rest. Today, may we find true rest from the exhaustion of our spinning and cycling within samsara. The beginning of the year is auspicious. The myriad things are all new. And the student says, "Thank you. Thank you for your answer." Which was what a student does when they've received a teaching or received the Dharma. Why does Xingqing say, "I lost virtue today"? Dadaroshi says, as a footnote, "Indeed, what a pity." Why does Xingqing, as teachers, say, "I have lost virtue today"? The monastic thanked his teacher for an answer because he had received something. And because of this, Xingqing says, "Ah, today I've lost virtue." Teacher to student, mind to mind, nothing is given, nothing is received. If you say that you've left here after this weekend with something that you didn't have before you came, today I lose virtue. The pure reality body, luminous and clear, is the Buddha nature, is self-nature of all things. And yet this body, your body and mine, you can't possess it. You can't touch it. You can't increase it. It will never diminish. And thus, we are liberated. Luminous and clear is our uncreated original mind. You can't purify it or clarify it, develop it or enlighten it. Thus, we are liberated. Another student asked another master, Fuori, the same question. It's Buddha Dharma, present at the beginning of the new year. And here, this teacher says no. And the student says, "Well, wait a minute. Every year is a good year. Every day is a good day." This is quoting from the teaching of Master Yunmen. "I don't ask you about before. I don't ask you about after. How is it in this very moment?" And then he himself answers, "Every day is a good day." And so this student is invoking that. Every year is a good year. Every day is a good year. How good year? How can this new year not be Buddha Dharma? For he says, "When old man Zhang drinks wine, old man Li gets drunk." If we make the smallest distinction, heaven and earth are broken apart. No old age and death. And yet aging and death surround us, are us. And so why does he say no Buddha Dharma in the new year? If every form of measurement, every division, every conflict is a result of mental activity, and it is, how can something which is fundamentally unified be broken? If heaven and earth are by their very nature one reality, how can they be broken? And so to see that, we have to let go of the breaking apart mind, the mind that divides and separates and measures. And that's a very difficult thing to do because that's the mind we trust. That's the mind we have been taught to trust implicitly, without question. Do not question it, in fact. In a sense, that's the constant refrain of delusion, of our attachments. Follow me, ask no questions. Follow me, do not look. Just follow me. And the revolution of Buddhist practice is to question, to look, to wonder. And that's why Dada Roshi says, if you go to the words and phrases to see into this, the measuring, the dividing, the distancing mind, we'll never understand. We might come up with some clever explanation, but so what? I mean, really? Do we need, are we lacking in clever explanations? Something else is needed. He says, if, however, you can free your mind and objects, don't just stop at freeing your mind, free everything, and attain liberation, then you will know how to be free from yes and no, and live then within yes and no. Every year is a good year. Every day is a good day. How is it not so in the new year? Good here means true, complete, originally without hindrance. It doesn't mean good according to your expectations or mine. It means true. It means original. And so the words that this student is saying are true, but does the student herself know it? Every teaching has one purpose, and that is to bring us directly and decidedly into ourselves. And so for he says, old man Zhang drinks wine, Li falls down drunk. The wind blows across the eastern shore, waves appear in the west. It's one ocean, one reality. Where is the division? When you grasp at things, I am distressed. And so the student says, old, big, big, a dragon head, a snake tail. A dragon is an enlightened being in Buddhism. A snakes always get the short end of the stick. A snake is a deluded being. And so a dragon head looks like an enlightened being, but it's got a snake body. So it's just pretense, it's contrivance. It's not true. And so that's what the student is saying to his teacher. A dragon head, a snake tail. And his teacher says, today I lost virtue. On the path to liberation, every step can only be a step within liberation itself. If the path were bringing us to a moment when we suddenly create a state of liberation, that by its very, that very path would be delusion, could only be suffering because by virtue of its creation, it will come apart. It is no refuge. It can only be that which cannot be created and cannot be destroyed, which means that every step in the path, we are in that very place. We are that very person that we are seeking. We can talk about beginning, middle, and end. We can talk about success and failure. We can talk about progress, and there is progress. Just like we can talk about the new year. And really the question keeps returning to, in our talking about it, is that skillful? Sometimes when we talk about it, it's not skillful. When we talk about progress, am I making progress? We can ask that question in a way that is actually skillful. Am I just noticing? Am I really practicing? Right? What am I noticing? But very often we ask that or have that perception in a way that isn't helpful. It leads to self-criticism, to frustration. It's based on expectations. And so in a very real sense, the practice is to, particularly in the Zen tradition, is good to go directly to the release, the relinquishment, the letting go of every form of creation, every division, every source of measuring, every idea, to realize that fundamental truth, the cold moon illuminating the endless mountain, where there's no feature, no quality, no characteristic, to realize that fundamental ground, that ocean of wisdom, and then through continued training to begin to step back into the world of yes and no, to step back into language and ideas, and now be able to develop our capacity to use them skillfully and not be used by them. Dukkha is a kind of a battleground. Not having what we want, wanting what we don't have. Being with people we don't really want to be with, not being with people we want to be with. A constant conflict, a kind of referendum on the worthiness of ourselves and others, on the value. When we see the self as autonomous and self-standing, even if we struggle and accomplish getting to the top, it's a harsh existence. Because we have to keep fighting to stay there. And of course, having fought together to the top, we don't recognize it as a top, right? In other words, this mountain has no summit. How do we step forward in a time, particularly as ours, of so much madness, so much greed, anger, and delusion, so much unabashed falseness? How do we step forward with confidence? There's a very interesting sutra in which the Buddha says, how does one build up hope in the future? A student just sent me to this with a question about hope. There isn't much hope in Buddhism. Hope means to have a feeling or expectation or desire for something to happen. Or to have hope in a person or a thing that's going to help us, or save someone else. Or it's to be standing on some grounds for believing that something good is going to happen. It's all forward thinking. It's all futuristic thinking. So how did the Buddha answer that question? How does one build up hope upon the future? Here's a radical response to this. He says, you nurture your delight in thinking, in giving voice to the heartfelt desire that I may have material form, that I may have feeling, that I may have perception, that I may have mental formations, and that I may have consciousness. It's what we call the skandhas. This is how we create, we interact with the world, inner and outer, and create our sense of the world. And that world can be a heaven or it can be a hell. It can be a divided, or we can realize it as unified. And what the Buddha is saying is the way to have hope is to have this human form. to be able to perceive, to be able to establish intention, to be able to make commitments and follow through, to be able to have vows. Isn't that incredible? That's how you have hope. There's nothing future about it, and yet, it is the only way that future, what we call future, which is just the next moment, will arise, is as a result of that. To nurture delight in thinking, may I appreciate this human form, its ability to see and to hear and to feel and to taste and touch and think, to imagine, to have intention, to make vows, to make choices, and to discern the choices I make, to recognize the consequences of my choices and to learn from that, to arouse compassion, to practice compassion within greed, anger, and delusion. You know, practicing compassion when you're angry is an incredibly powerful thing. The thing is, when we're in it, it just doesn't look like what we think compassion is supposed to look like. Because we think of compassion as not being angry. But how do you manifest compassion when you're angry? May I not waste this day, this year, this life in things that are not skillful, not helpful, not important, not liberating, not serving myself and you. May I seek true Dharma, a genuine path, and having found it, may I study it, practice and realize it. May I be fearless, may I develop courage in being able to face what is difficult to face, to tolerate what is difficult to tolerate. In this, there is no expectation. There is no deal making, right? I'm going to do this, but I'm going to get that. There's just. And so in this form of hope the Buddha speaks of, there is no disappointment because it's not predicated on a deal, a bargain. I mean, nobody's life turns out the way we imagined, right? I mean, that's just sort of the way it works. And I mean, think about what if it did? What if your life turned out exactly as you had imagined it? It probably wouldn't be a very interesting life, right? It's because of all of the slings and arrows that we have the opportunity to bring forth what the Buddha is describing as hope because we have this vessel. And because it's impermanent, don't lollygag. Be patient. Patience is an incredibly powerful force. It's a force. It's not a passive thing. Before the new year, the cold moon illuminates the endless mountain. And so to discover that still point, that true body of reality, free of thoughts, free of past, present, and future, that's luminous and clear, to let go of time and space, fixing, broken, worthy and unworthy. After the new year, the sweet fragrance of apple blossoms fills the valley. Seeing into self-nature, leap forth. Move forth. Barefoot and naked of breast, the 10th Oxfordian picture downstairs at the end of the long path. Barefooted and naked of breast, I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged, laden with dust, and I am ever blissful. I don't need magic to extend my life. It's no longer about living as long as I can. I take care of this vessel because it is my vessel. It's how I bring forth whatever benefit I can. But it's not about extending it as long as possible because I don't want to let go. Using no magic to extend my life. Now, all around me, the dead trees come alive. Everything that appeared dead, everything that appeared lifeless, everything that appeared hopeless is alive. An incredible image. So I'll end with this teaching by Longchenpa. He says, your liberation depends on you. That's the good news. That's the good news. What is needed in order to live this life in fulfillment belongs to you and depends on you for its very fulfillment. You know, we like to think that if hope was having someone come and save us, that would be the good thing, because then I can just sort of hang out, you know, just have my bags packed and be ready to go, but basically just wait for that phone to ring. But the thing is, you can't leave. You can't leave the house because you got to be there to answer it. And what if they don't have your number, right? Or the phone never rings. Or the person on the other end is like, you know, a jerk. Your liberation depends on you. The Buddha has shown us this. Because that's what he realized. He realized you. He realized me. He enlightened you. He enlightened me. No one else can save you through sudden intervention. I remember in the early years sitting here in moments of despair and hopelessness and thinking, you know, I'm just never going to get this. I'm never getting anywhere. I'm like, you know, blah, 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 pity, 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 sad, sad, sad. And secretly, quietly, I was waiting for one of the monitors to come up and comfort me, to hold me, right, to say, it's okay, you've got what it takes, you can do it. They never did that. There was a moment towards the very end of my mom's life where I was laying next to her in bed, and I just rested my hand very gently on her hand. And she was, you know, not conscious in an obvious way anymore. And I just rested my hand on hers, and she moved it. And I thought, And I just laid there for a while, and then I did it again. I just rested on her hand, and she moved, and I said, okay. Okay, you need to be alone now, right? This is not what you need, right? You now are at that point when you're communicating. You don't need intervention. I cannot help you now. This is your work. Therefore, he says, the time has come. Apply yourself as you ascend freedom's path. The time has come. Yes.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.